Hilliard Lyons is proud to become a part of Baird, a trusted financial services firm that shares our commitment to the community. I'm Jeff Main, branch manager with Hilliard Lyons. You can learn more about Baird and our new partnership at HilliardToBaird.com.
We have the deputy mayor of the city of Bloomington, Mick Renneisen.
Good afternoon, Mick. How are you?
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I just want to say that as Bill Maher says on Real Time, when he has a guest on with a job that he found interesting, you'd say, well, that's my old job. And you actually just mentioned one of my old jobs. I used to work with Joe Smith, providing statistical analysis and a little bit of color commentating on high school football. So when you said high school football at Edgewood and his counterpart would be working with him, I thought, well, that's something I used to do many moons ago. And enjoyed very much working with the Hall of Famer Joe Smith.
Everybody does. Smitty's a piece of work in a good way. There's some guys that are a piece of work and you stop talking. Smitty's a good piece of work, so that's interesting. And your statistical anomaly, Mick, is, well, it's not an anomaly. It's taken you to some very interesting places. When do you think you will hear from your friends at the Lahaina Civic Center wondering if they will welcome you back, you and your crew, to run the stat bench at the Maui Gym, Maui Classic, coming up, scheduled, fingers crossed, for November?
Well, like all college basketball fans, we're all hoping that the Hoosiers will be able to go to Maui and all the fans that want to go there, and if not, go watch on TV, as that is the premier preseason college basketball tournament. I think I've seen four different scenarios for how the Big Ten and the NCAA might potentially start the season, anywhere from on time to a pre-Thanksgiving start to a post-Thanksgiving start to a January start. So I think they're examining a lot of options, understandably so, with the pandemic still not quite under control and far, far from having large gatherings like venues, even there at 2,200 people in a small facility. It's your elbow to elbow.
Well, that's the problem with that facility, Mick, is because everybody, A, wants to be there, and it is sardines at 2,200. So there isn't an empty seat, because that's a huge driver for all these universities, for everybody to go. And, there's not room to spread out in such a place.
No, and my hope is we'll know by the middle of September. That seems to be the target date that most of the conferences are thinking that the decision makers will have to come to some terms with the amount of practices that would need to be held and gearing up for the season to start in November. They need to know by mid-September. So I suppose we're a couple weeks away, maybe about three shows from now, we ought to be able to answer that question.
And Jeff Goodman, who writes for Watch Stadium, polled over 250 athletic directors. I don't know if you read the same article I did, but those numbers were very similar about, you know, when for basketball, when are we going to do this? When are we going to do that? And what you painted, that picture there, the Power Six, as he calls them, including the Big East for basketball, saying January was, quote-unquote, the most likely of those four choices. But that's, again, that's an informal poll. What does it mean? Well, that's what it means on the 27th day of August. So here we are. Here we are a week later, and you guys went through all the budget processes last week. Or was that this week? Am I lost? Where are we? What are we doing? What's next there?
No, you didn't lose sight of where we were. Last week was budget presentation week, over 21 hours of public discussion and presentations by our 17 departments presenting to our city council with public comment each of the four nights, Monday through Thursday last week. And subsequently, the city council has sent us questions. We received them today, 135 questions. I think that's a new record. I don't recall us being in that number before. It's usually somewhere between 70 and a low 100. So more questions this year, which is fine. We will be working on getting answers to the council. Those will be published publicly as well. Our target date is to get them back to council by September 9th. And then our next public meeting is September 30th, when the budget is actually formally introduced as an ordinance. That means appropriating money, and it has to be introduced as an ordinance. And then discussion on the 30th, with final passage on October 14th. So that's the upcoming deadlines, including now the new information of the number of questions that council submitted to our respective departments for answers. And then, of course, we'll circulate those to the public as well.
Mick, why do you think there are so many additional questions? I mean, almost double if you think 70-ish is the normal type. Is it just hyper detail oriented? Is it policy oriented? Tell me why you think there's more.
Well, I think Tuesday night we cleared a path for a robust discussion about public safety, and that largely focused on policing. And that conversation was continued again last night, with another two-hour session held by the City Council's Public Safety Committee. And I think we're just all, you know, trying to listen and learn how the community would like to see policing in this century be different from past years. And I guess I would offer a couple of things about that is we completely understand that this is a moment in time that the country is going through getting its collective head wrapped around some things that are going on, racism, white supremacy, biases that are just no longer tolerable. And we get it. And we're hearing loud and clear from people that that is a concern of theirs. So we're open to listening to ideas and ways that we can make our public safety entity, that's police and fire and several other entities that are sort of affiliated with public safety in any community. For us, that would be our administration, community and family resources, who interacts a lot with the social service agencies, which, you know, help get to the root of some of the challenges that cause policing to be needed in communities. And we know there's new models out there that we want to talk about and explore with our community. Can all those things be done, wrapped up and fixed in one budget cycle? No. But the dialogue is open and it will continue to be open and will need to be something that we work towards doing the best we can to improve. Having said all that, I think our police department, by and large, does a really good job. You don't see the same incidents. That's not to suggest that we don't have bias or potential racism and all those things inherent in any workforce that you would explore those same things in. But right now, the policing area is the one under a lot of scrutiny, and we all know why, because of the things that have happened, again, as recently as just a few days ago in Kenosha, Wisconsin. So we need to pay attention to it. We are. And so that's why we're going to have more questions about our policing model and changes we might consider making in the future. And that's the reason why we have 135 questions. Many of them are about the policing component of our budget.
Well, that and I don't have any questions about those questions, but we are seeing some unprecedented times as well in the financial realm of things with tax collection, et cetera, where the city still has to provide all of those services. There have to be some tough questions that have to be answered budgetarily there as well, I would think.
Right. And we're really thinking of this as two more budgets besides the one we're in now. We're thinking about what happens when the recessive activity of the pandemic being caused now really hits the city's coffers in terms of our revenue streams, reminding the public that our revenue streams are property taxes, local option income taxes, and then revenues generated by various departments, very, very small part of that, the two primary are property and income. Well, income would be the one that's going to lag as unemployment numbers have gone up. But the way that that number is calculated, it's over 7 quarters. So the state still presumes from 7 quarters ago that the economy is going well enough that next year's revenue and income tax revenue won't be as bad as the year after when the 7 quarters catches up with us. And today's unemployment quarters go on the rolls for projecting revenue for the budget of 2022. So we know that and we're planning for that. And that's why the mayor's introduced the idea of not just the Recover Forward funds and spending rainy day funds in the 2021 budget, but considering how do we sustain that momentum of the investments we're making in our community to help it recover from this economic calamity, but also how do we invest in things that we were talking about before the pandemic hit? How do we talk about racial justice and equity, and how do we work on climate change, and then how do we continue to have our economy recover and be strong? So those are three pillars of our budget proposal, not just for 2021, but thinking beyond 2021 when revenue will become even tighter.
Mick, we've been so tied up with the budget and the pandemic and all of these other things. What about the routine business of the council and the city? What's happening with respect to all of that?
Yeah, that's a great question, Keith. I think during the very beginning of the pandemic in March, when we were all starting to realize what we were facing and how it was changing city service delivery, the council also decided to kind of say, well, let's not bring anything forward that's not quote unquote an emergency. we've got them to gradually see that, you know, we still have to do the city's business. We still have to plug in where we can other things that have to move forward. So what might some of those things be? We've got some ordinance changes that just have to happen. They're just sort of routine things you do every year. They're cleanup things. You find something in the code that's the code is what drives city policy, and it's what the laws say we have to do that the city council enacts. And we find examples of things that are outdated or aren't practically being applied anymore, and you correct them. So those sort of housekeeping routine things we've kind of put on the back burner. In the last quarter, you should expect to see, the public should expect to see us come back to that and say, well, we've put those off long enough. We really need to do some of those things to fix them up. That includes fees and fines and a whole array of categorical things we just have not touched on most recently. But most of our time has been spent on pandemic-related matters. The recovery funds that we asked for a special appropriation was one of those examples. We aren't doing it, fortunately for us, we don't have a lot of the comprehensive plan, unified development ordinance things on the agenda now, or they would be pushed back. But we will next year. We have a map that's going to show all the zoning overlays that will have to be presented to council. That's likely to come forward early 2021. So we're starting to see a little bit of scheduling of those more routine things coming forward in this last quarter.
Let me ask you, in that area, where are we on all of that annexing thing that we were going through?
So that's all in the state's hands. You know, the city sued the state and said, we don't think that the way that this legislation was put together was anything but special legislation. It only affected one community in Indiana, Bloomington. And that's called special legislation for a reason. That's illegal. And so we appealed, and we're in the process of the state's appeal to see how that will be resolved. So until the courts resolve that, that's just kind of one of those things that's an outlier. It'll hang in the balance. And even if the decision, when the decision is made, whichever way it's made, you know, if it's, hey, too bad, Bloomington, that's, you lose, then it's over. If it's the other case where the city's appeal is granted, then we would have to consider the timing of moving forward with any of those plans. Right now, it's a moot point because it's in the court's hands at the moment.
Another thing that's in the court's hands, Mick, is the back and forth with, was it the Planning Commission member or where somebody in Greene County is now in charge of watching over that? Where does that one stand?
Also in the courts. So, you know, that's just to recap that real quickly. The mayor has appointments to the Planning Commission. The mayor chose to appoint a replacement for a member that we no longer wanted to have on the Planning Commission when their term expired. The recent law change of about a year or two ago suggested that if there was no appointment made by a certain time frame, that the minority party in the community, which is the Republican Party, the chair of that committee could appoint someone to take that position. So that's what happened. Mr. Ellis, the Republican Party chair, went ahead and appointed somebody else. We didn't think that was appropriate. And so we appointed our own person, happens to be a Republican, by the way, to fill the vacancy that the mayor's appointment had. And right now that's in a court case to determine if it was conducted properly and whether or not the appointment made by the Republican Party chair is valid or our appointment is valid.
Go ahead. We're speaking with Mick Renneisen, the deputy mayor of the city of Bloomington. And Mick, one of the other things, last night, you had Jim Sims' committee meeting on public safety. What are you reading coming out of all this? You had the big meeting on the budget that developed into a police kind of situation. And then the public safety meeting had to do with a lot of how people perceive and what they want and what they think they need to do with the police department. Where is all of this headed?
Yeah, Keith, I think that is, it's back to what we were talking about, the number of questions that we got related to the budget and the policing presentation of the budget. Last night was another opportunity for the community to vocalize. I think on the Tuesday night budget presentation by the police chief, Mike Dekoff, there were so many people, there were over 225 people on Zoom that night. Not everyone that wanted to speak, although 73 people spoke, I think felt like they had enough opportunity to speak. So Councilmember Sims wanted to have this committee he chairs, public safety of the council, four members, have another chance for people who either didn't get a chance to speak or want to speak again, talk about the police budget and or anything else about policing policy. And that's what last night was about. Another 90 people were on the call, and a smaller number spoke, but still, you know, there were still people concerned, and new incidents have happened even from last week to this week, which just heightened the sensitivity, appropriately so, for making sure something like the activities we've seen elsewhere don't happen here. So I think it's totally fair and understandable. And I'm not a person of color, and any of us that aren't can't put ourselves in the shoes of people who are. Amen. We have to be understanding, amen, and sensitive to what they feel. And it's not only what they feel, but what we see happening to people of color around the country. And we don't want that to happen here. So it's totally understandable that there's a lot of concern and questions being asked. Again, I'll say we haven't had those happen here, but that doesn't mean they can't. It doesn't mean they won't. And a member of our community pointed something out that I think is reminds me that I don't remember everything that happened in my life in Bloomington. I thought we hadn't had a shooting of an African-American, and we did, Denver Smith, back 30 or plus years ago. So it's not fair to say we've never had it happen here. We have. So we have to be aware, sensitive, and listen to those who have concerns, and we should be willing to make change if change is required, and be willing to open up the doors and peel back the sheets and say, well, look at the department. What is it doing that you don't like? What could it do better? At the same time, I'm going to say for them, they really do a lot of things that most city police departments, not only in Indiana, but elsewhere, just simply don't do. And I want them to get some credit for the good things they do.
And Mick, one of those things that we've heard from the mayor himself is it's a hard time to bring in police officers. You ask and you put the things out there, and you don't have a ton of applicants. Does that say something about the force as well? Do we need to pay our officers more? I mean, of course, everybody wants more money in their job. That's simple. But if we keep growing as a city, we're going to have to fill those spots with some officers at some point.
Sure. So there's several things going on from my perspective and listening to, and we just had negotiations for a fairly extended period of time with our local FOP, and they brought up some of the issues you brought up, Glass. Is pay sufficient? Are the benefits sufficient? They recognize recruitment and retainment is just as important as recruitment. What can we do to retain the trained officers that we have so we don't lose them to other police law enforcement agencies? So all those things are part of that NOVAC study, the organizational assessment, that we'll be working with our police department and the community on deciding, okay, what of these recommendations are the right ones for the right time, and you know, which ones are not relevant at the moment or maybe relevant at all. Studies give you options to consider. That doesn't mean that everything in there should be implemented or everything should be implemented right away. So that's a community discussion that we're, I think, just beginning to have, and we have a lot of information for the community, the administration, the city council to review and be thoughtful about how do we want to shape policing in Bloomington in the future. That's a fair question to ask.
Mick, as you go by Walnut, you're seeing that 4th Street garage is coming along very quickly.
I actually got a chance to put a hard hat on and take a tour of our Trades District garage this afternoon. So while standing on the top of the Trades District garage with I was with our project manager and two members of CFC who were obviously our adjacent property owners. And I said, how many parking garages can you see from this parking garage? And the answer was, you can see all of them. You can see the top of the crane from 4th Street. You can see the Morton Street garage at college. You can see the one at Walnut and 7th Street. And you can see the county's parking garage across from City Hall. So there's quite a few parking structures now kind of lined up and ready for a recovery of our economy. It's been one of those silver lining blessings of because there's less traffic, the construction process has been a little easier to perform for our contractors. They don't have to compete with places to park their vehicles while they're on the job, and they have more flexibility of flowing and bringing the materials and supplies and cranes in without competing with a lot of traffic. At the same time, you know, we're in an unprecedentedly low demand for parking because people are not going to their normal places of work and are not doing their normal shopping and eating out. And of course, we want all that to return when it's safe to do so. And we think these structures will be ready for that. Let's not forget, because I know that there are folks who rightfully advocate for less parking and more alternative transportation. This isn't a one size fits all. We're not just talking about parking and parking capacity for people with cars. We're also removing parking from the streets. The council just approved a removal of 113 spaces on 7th Street beginning in 2021 for the 7 line, which is a bike ped connector to the B line to campus. And
well, Mick, not to mention all the parklets and everything else that goes on with the bollards. Yep. You can make an argument there's going to be more than that if we tend moving in that direction.
And we're learning a lot in this pilot program of trying things while there's less traffic because of the economic challenges about some of these things that may, in fact, remove more parking. And therefore, our parking structures would be the appropriate place for people to go to, which is what happens in big cities, right? There's not a lot of on-street parking. You go to parking structures and you bring your walking shoes and schlep your other shoes.
I'm not walking two blocks. What, have you ever been to New York City or Chicago? My goodness, two blocks is a miracle.
And we're not there yet. But, no. You know, we're certainly a growing community that will eventually evolve into hopefully more transit, bicycle, pedestrian-friendly modes of transportation. At the same time, some people who will come into our community to spend money or work here from outside of our city are going to have to continue to drive in to do those things. So it's just a balancing act.
Deputy Mayor Mick Rennheisen is our guest this afternoon. We talked to Mayor Hamilton on Tuesday. He mentioned the fact that the city of Bloomington was going to be testing, tracing, looking at wastewater, trying to get ahead of perhaps an outbreak or anything else with COVID. I didn't do a good job of asking him a follow-up question, so I'm gonna ask it to you, and if this is out of your pay grade, I apologize. How often does that happen, or is it just a standard added test daily that you get a report back on? I don't know, so that's why I ask you.
It's happening several times a week.
Okay.
At between 6 and 10 locations, I believe, both wastewater treatment plants, Blucher Pool and forgive me for forgetting the second one, both wastewater treatment plants, and then also at some other select locations where we have the equipment, the testing equipment.
Gotcha. Well, we talk about testing and all this, Mick, and I just don't know how frequent we can do it, whether it's human beings or water or anything else.
Well, this is all grant funded. It's kind of a cutting edge thing that other communities, not very many, are doing. And so we're trying to help with the research modality to try to discover if this isn't a way to help predict where outbreaks might occur, because this is happening more quickly and can discern if there's an area of our community where if the count of COVID-related viruses is prevalent in the water source and it changes week over week, then we know we have a problem and we know to go pinpoint that area with our county health department colleagues to try to make sure that we can catch an outbreak before it gets bigger.
Mick, I saw a thing that indicates that we're going to get some scooters with seats in the city.
That is true. There's a
remember when scooters were a big problem here, Mick? Remember that was a thing? Remember when people are angry?
Just like any new technology, when it first comes in, it just at the time that horses were no longer as prevalent as cars, there was the same issue. So
can we trade scooters for COVID? Is that possible? Should we have to throw in a player to be named later?
I'd gladly trade a lot of things to replace COVID and put COVID on the bench permanently. Sooner than later would be great. Seated scooters are motorized scooters are another form of transportation that gets you in the last mile, so to speak, so that you can get out of your car or maybe not use one at all and go from point A to point B.
But one of my questions is, it's not convenient parking, like if there is such a thing as convenient parking for scooters. These are taking up more space and has special needs, I think, is the way I would refer to it.
They do, and therefore we've not allowed as many of them, and we've not allowed them permanently. We're examining how they work and don't work, and then we'll work with the company, and I forget which company.
See, when they just
is.
Don't drop them out of the sky one morning, Keith, right. This is how you do business, and this is how we can work around it. So this makes more sense. And Mick, you put them through the trials and tribulations, and if they want to help out to have their seated scooters in town, well, we'll work together.
I want to see when they ride double on a seated scooter.
Keith, just wait till it gets dark.
Don't encourage that behavior, Keith.
Keith, no. Just wait.
I've seen him do double on the stand-up one, so.
Mick, the BMW Championship PGA Tour FedEx Cup playoff event number 2 of 3 is happening at historic Olympia Fields Golf Club on the south side of Chicago. The top 69 players left in the FedEx Cup playoffs are dueling for a pool of, let's see, 9.5. Winner gets 1.71 million. And the top 30 next week go to Eastlake for the Tour Championship. Webb Simpson decided he's going to take the week off and rest up. But the other 69 players are there as we get underway with, look at this, we have rough and wind and firm greens and fast greens. This is U.S. Open-y type stuff. Do you have a prediction for us this week before Celeste thrashes us with her trivia?
Rory McIlroy.
Wow. You think he's going to turn it around and get it figured out this week? I like
it. Yeah, he hasn't all summer, but I that he's too good of a player to not find some magic at some point. So he's running out of time, so I'm going to give him this week to figure it out.
You're going to load him up. Well, I have good news for you and bad news for you. Are you ready? Mr. McIlroy has made 3 birdies on the front side. He has also made 3 bogeys and is even par T14. So just gives you where we're at with par being a good score this week. So he is making some birdies. He is making some bogeys as well. The leaders are just 2 under as everybody started, I think, the last group or the first group out's on 16. There are 4 players tied for the lead. Billy Horschel, Patrick Reed, Tom Hoagie, and Tyler Duncan, who won me a ton of stuff last week. Thank you to the Purdue graduate. They are all 2 under par. We've put it off as long as possible, and we knew our Zoom time is coming to an end here. So we will take our beating from Celeste, as we always do every Thursday here on WGCL. It's time for trivia!
Let me give you one other little piece of information for our listeners before we jump into trivia, and that's that the dog park at Switchyard Park opens tomorrow night.
All right.
Officially ready to be opened at 5:30.
Happy hour dog park.
The mayor teased that on Tuesday.
Yeah, and it will remain open daily after tomorrow from 5 a.m. to 11 p.m., except on Tuesdays from 5 to noon when routine maintenance will be performed. As is always the case for your outdoor activities, social distancing and masks will still be required, but we're real pleased that the turf is ready and the park, the 2 dog park facilities at Switchyard Park will open tomorrow. The mayor will be there for the opening. There'll be free Frisbees and many hand sanitizers for you or your dogs.
Mick, I can't get my dog to wear a mask, though.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
Will it stay 6 feet away from another dog?
Probably not. You have to put one of those lampshades on their head.
Yeah.
That's there you go.
Safety
first.
All right,
here's your trivia.
Safety
first.
Right.
We talked a little bit about biking earlier. It's become even a more popular way of getting around in the age of social distancing. And our public trails, like the new 7 line that we just talked about as well, which is in progress in design, won't be started in construction until next year, but nonetheless an exciting project that connects to the B-line. So as bikes sell out and America tools around town on its new rides, this week's trivia is all about the 2-wheeled machines. Approximately how many gallons of oil would be saved if Americans biked 1% more often, just 1%, how many gallons of oil would be saved? Would it be A, 10 million, B, 925,000, C, 10 billion, or D, 925 million gallons of oil?
Gallons of oil. Barrels of oil.
She throws in that.
If Americans bike just 1% more than they do now.
I'm going to go with the 925 because I think it's either she made up a great number or it means something.
Well, there's 350 million Americans.
Yeah.
Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Math. I have no idea. What are my choices again? 10 trillion, what are we doing here?
10 million, 10 billion, 925,000, or 925 million?
1% more. Well, this is difficult. Well, give me the 1,000 one.
925,000, and Keith took 925 million.
Yes.
And Keith is the winner of this answer this round.
Did it again.
Bike trips currently only account for about 1% of all travel in America. So doubling it by doubling it from 1% to 2 saves 925 million gallons of oil annually. That's amazing. Wow.
That is amazing. I didn't think the beginning number was that high, hence my answer. So I've learned something, as I always do, with the ruler across my knuckles from Celeste.
Question number 2. How many bicycles are built worldwide in the average year?
Not enough would be the answer for 2020.
It's hard to get them now.
Yeah, that's true. 100 million, 10 billion, 10 million, or 1 billion?
Can I go first?
Go ahead.
10 billion.
I'll go,
there's 6 billion there's a couple billion Chinese, the world's population is about 7 billion. Then you should say a billion. I think you'd be right. I think I've overshot my mark here trying to do math.
Give me the numbers one more time, Mick.
Yep. 1 billion, 10 billion, 10 million, or 100 million?
I'm going 1 billion.
I think Keith's right.
You guys both are a little high on this, but it's 100 million. Oh. The demand may be closer to what you guys are suggesting now, as people are looking for alternative ways to get around, but currently it's only 100 million. So
see, I'm bad at math, and Celeste, I don't know how she knows that, but that's what's killing me in these things. I have to do math equations, and I'm not very smart.
Glass, your point about China is currently home to over 500 million bikes.
All right.
I imagine they're the leader in the clubhouse on that.
By a few. And our friends in the subcontinent as well, India and all those folks.
For sure.
A couple billion hanging out there. All right.
Third and final question. God. Which brothers used a small bicycle shop in Ohio as their base of operation? Was it Frank
Wright
and
brothers.
Jesse James?
No, it was the Wright brothers.
Are you kidding?
Yeah.
She asked that kind. Oh, come on, Celeste.
Well, you listen to these questions, at least the answers. You'll get a kick out of this.
Okay.
Frank and Jesse James, Wilhelm and Jacob Grimm, Stephen and Seth Curry, or Orville and Wilbur Wright, which you already jumped
ahead.
Yeah,
wow.
Well, I thought, or the Schwinn brothers, were they from Ohio?
Yeah.
Yeah, that
was too easy.
That was a good one.
Wow.
Everybody forgets they're from Ohio because they flew in Kitty Hawk.
That's right.
So, but no, that's where the Wright State University and all the Air Museum stuff that there. It's
Patterson
really cool. I need to get
Space.
Over there and look at that again whenever that opens up. Good job, Celeste. You make us think. You make us work. And in 10 seconds, this meeting is going to end. Mick, thank you so much. We'll see you next week.
Take care, Mick.
Thanks, guys.